I'd like to thank the organisers of this wonderful conference for the opportunity to speak, and particularly to speak in this session with two such distinguished colleagues who've prepared very profound and learned remarks, and I've been grateful for them indeed. I'm going to pick up two of the themes in my address that have been mentioned, and they are matters relating to rights that derive from the Constitution and also the question of vilification and public opinion. And I'd like to address my remarks in these stages. I'd like to give some examples of where that type of vilification occurs in response to unpopular opinion. I'd like to talk also about the court of public opinion, which is obviously not a properly constituted court, but has a great deal of power, I think not only in Australia, but in most Western democracies these days. Then I'd like to talk about how those principles have informed and elucidated a debate that we've had recently, as was in the introduction from Craig, before two legislatures, before the House Committee of the House of Representatives, which is our federal parliament, and the Senate, and also before the Tasmanian Parliament. And so if I can address my remarks in that way, perhaps I can pick up on some of the themes that have been so well developed by my colleagues. One of the great things about the common law tradition is that it's based on stories. I mean, common lawyers just love to tell stories, and they really get off on them, even if they're not true sometimes. They just love stories. But I'd like to tell you a couple of true stories. You might say, well, what's all of this discussion got to do with religious freedom when we're talking about same-sex marriage, which is what I'm going to address some of my remarks to? And let me illustrate the connection in this way. Recently, I was in London with my wife for the World Bar Conference. And the World Bar Conference is a gathering of barristers throughout the world where they congratulate each other on how learned they are and then try to learn more from each other. But while we were there, there were two sets of headlines that drew our attention. Some were the remarks of one of your presidential candidates during his visit at the time, which seemed to draw a lot of press. But there was also a comment that I found in one of the respected daily journals in London, by Nicholas Clegg. Nicholas Clegg is the Deputy Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. And he was commenting on same-sex marriage. As some of you may be aware, the United Kingdom Conservative government is moving towards legalising same-sex marriages. And what Nicholas Clegg did was interesting, and in fact, I think from a religious perspective, he may have let the cat out of the bag. What he said was, well, of course we're going to introduce religious exemptions, and we're not going to force any church to solemnise any gay marriage that happens to occur. We won't force any minister or pastor or member of the clergy to solemnise them for now. He said, once it becomes socially and politically acceptable, we can't see any reason upon which any member of the cloth could refuse what is a basic human right. And so that is the connection that I'd like to make to the discourse that we're having generally in this conference, that there are agendas we have to be alive to, and there are ways in which we need to combat them. And what I'm going to respectfully submit is that the way in which they should be combated is not necessarily to engage in the polemic and the rhetoric that is used in the political discourse, but to resort to a legal approach and particularly a constitutional approach. Now, let me just give you a couple of other examples about the operation of the Court of Public Opinion. The member of the Australian Christian Lobby, and indeed their leader, Jim Wallace, made some remarks recently in a public debate where he argued against same-sex marriage. And one of the things that he talked about were the health implications of a homosexual lifestyle. Everything else that he said on that occasion, everything else that he mentioned in his debate, every other argument that was developed by him, cogently and logically, was ignored by the press. And all that was mentioned was that he was prejudiced against gays because he was saying it was an unhealthy lifestyle. And he was pilloried for days on end by headline after headline, by newsreel after newsreel, making him look ridiculous by quoting him out of context and by making him look like he was a right-wing redneck that had no bones of tolerance in his entire body. And it was a brutal thing that occurred to him. Then, during the debates on the same-sex bills that are currently before the Parliament at the moment, Senator Cory Bernardi happened to cite the fact that it was the policy of one of the parties that is promoting same-sex marriage also eventually to legalise bestiality. Because he mentioned the words homosexuality and bestiality in the same sentence as I have just done, he was fired from his position in the party, almost drummed out of Parliament, and was made a pariah politically and completely silenced by the Court of Public Opinion. The Court of Public Opinion is very powerful. And so one doesn't need to worry about the Racial and Religious Tolerance Act in order to see draconian measures being administered against those who offend its precepts. Anyone who says anything publicly that is not in keeping with the popular mood, that it in any way offends the currently popular minority or the currently popular cause, is running a huge risk of being pilloried and vilified in the press and made an outcast in public debate. So much so that whatever the logic may be of their argument, it will not be heard. It will be drowned out by the shrill screams that they are an extremist, intolerant, not to be listened to, homophobic it might be. It might be that they're a global warming denier. Whatever it might be, if it's a politically unpopular opinion, you can be sure that you will be in deep trouble with both the press and the popular media, as well as popular opinion. So recently I was approached to lead a team that would advance arguments against the legalisation of same-sex marriage. And as I said, we did that before the House Committee, which ran a committee on two of the bills that were before that House. And I also appeared before a Senate committee where similar arguments had to be advanced in respect of two bills that had their provenance in that House. And I said to my colleagues that the only way in which we should advance an argument, if we're going to advance one at all, should be one that is based upon constitutional principles. Being aware that whenever you advance any sort of opinion that might be based on sociology or religious view, theology, any one of the imprecise social sciences, you'll get a countervailing view come back, but you'll also have your view drowned out in the court of public opinion. And so we developed constitutional arguments in respect of, first of all, the federal bills, and then we also developed constitutional arguments with respect to the Tasmanian bill. And so far we've been successful in having each of those bills voted down on which we've addressed. As Craig said, there are two surviving bills, but it's unlikely politically that they'll have any life because their sister bills have been voted down politically. So just to address briefly in the time that we have, if I can just step through the arguments on the federal bill, and then if I can address arguments on the Tasmanian bill. The federal bill constitutional argument has two steps. The original meaning of marriage, as it finds its way into Section 51 of our Constitution, is the one that it had in 1901 when the Constitution was passed into law, which is that of Hyde and Hyde. And that is that marriage is a union between a man and a woman entered voluntarily for life to the exclusion of all others. So it really, by its nature, as a definition, is also prohibitive. Something that is between people who are not man and woman is not marriage. Something that is not voluntary or for the term of life is not marriage. It has those inherent prohibitions that pertain to the definition itself. The second argument that we had, and if I can just stay with the first argument first, though, there are four chief justices so far in constitutional precedent who have agreed with that. And, in fact, the vast body of constitutional law says exactly that, that the meaning of marriage is what it was in 1901, and that there is no other institution of marriage that can be recognised constitutionally in Australia. The second argument that we advanced was that meeting an argument that there could be some resort to the foreign affairs power, because the same-sex movement have said, well, there are international covenants that Australia has to give effect to, And we're not a monist jurisdiction. In other words, just because we sign up to an international covenant doesn't mean it becomes part of the domestic law. It has to pass through the legislature before it becomes part of domestic law. And they were saying that it was a gross omission that we had signed up to international covenants that permitted gay marriage, but were not permitting it at the domestic level. We looked at those arguments very carefully. We looked at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 16. We looked at the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. We also looked at the Hague Convention on the Celebration and Recognition of the Validity of Marriage, and found in none of those documents anything that could be remotely said to support same-sex marriage. At the best, there's an ambiguity in the Hague Convention that might be drawn upon. And, in fact, there were European precedents that we drew upon to have those matters clarified. And in Scholkenkopf and Austria, it was made quite clear by the European Court that there was no necessity to recognise marriage in order to give homosexual couples the same equality and rights. They did not have to have an identity in the institution in order to have equality in the institution. It was enough that Austria permitted registration of the relationship for there to be equality. The same sort of trend was picked up in Agar et Dubois en France, in a 2012 decision where a lesbian couple was denied right to adopt. Drawing upon the precedent of Schalk and also Johnston in Ireland, the court unanimously, in a single opinion, said that they did not have that right under any of the European covenants, which, of course, draw upon the United Nations covenants. And in Johnston, Ireland, the question was whether divorce was a right, and the court said that it was not a right, it was a privilege, and did not need to be accorded under any of those covenants. Those arguments found sway in the minority opinion of the report, but in the majority of the House. They were accepted, and when the two bills that we're talking about at the moment were presented, they were defeated 2-1 in terms of a majority. So they were soundly defeated and really have no prospects of any revival at the federal level at this stage. In order to put some political pressure on the federal government, the Tasmanian government, under pressure from one of the extreme left parties, the Greens, introduced legislation into their lower house to have state-based same-sex marriage. And that passed narrowly in the lower house, and when it came to the upper house, we were invited to make submissions as to whether that law would be constitutional if it were passed. Our argument was a three-staged argument as to why it would not be permitted. The 1961 Marriage Act made it quite clear that it was intended to be a codification of marriage laws in Australia and to give the federal government a legislative monopoly on the topic of marriage. And that's quite clear from the House debates. And indeed, the Attorney-General, Sir Garfield Barwick, when he took that bill through the House, made it quite plain that there was only going to be one law on marriage in Australia. That then became the subject of an amendment in 2004 where the Hyde and Hyde definition, just to make matters absolutely clear, was passed by vast majorities in both the House of Representatives and the Senate, and that definition that we find in Hyde and Hyde became part of the Marriage Act. So therefore, the federal parliament had pronounced on the definition of marriage at the federal level. The second stage in the argument is Section 109 of our Constitution gives legislative and constitutional supremacy to federal law. So any state law that is the subject of concurrent legislative power, if it is a field, a legislative field, in which the federal parliament has already legislated, that state law is, to the extent of its inconsistency with the federal law, invalid and cannot operate. And our argument was that because parliament, the federal parliament, had legislated to define marriage for all purposes in Australia, any redefinition by a state would be invalid to the extent of that redefinition. And so our third argument was that there was no question that this bill was an intention to enter into a prohibited legislative field. So in that way, although it hasn't avoided the hate mail that one would expect from the pro-gay lobby, it hasn't avoided any type of vilification entirely, It has muted that sort of response because our arguments were purely legal and constitutional and confined to what could be agreed upon as an agreed basis of debate. Is it constitutional or not, as opposed to whether it's a good thing, healthy thing, happy thing, these value judgment loaded types of arguments. We stayed away from those and stayed strictly to precedent. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.